Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the November 2024 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you to our sponsors once again, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together. I'm Rimley Crow, and I am joined by our panelists, Jeff Rollman, Dave Page, and Dr. Bill Toon. And as always, our discussion is going to be paired with an article that will be written by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce, in EMS World called Journal Watch. Encourage all of you listeners to check that out. It's at emsworld.com under the category of education and training. And now I would like to introduce some of our special guests for the day. We have a real treat. First, we have special guest panelist, Dr. Ryan Feldman. Welcome and thank you for joining us.
Hi. Is this where I give a little background about?
Yeah, we'd love to hear a little bit about who you are, what you do.
Sure. Awesome. So my name is Ryan Feldman. I have a few roles. I'm an emergency medicine pharmacist at Frederick Hospital, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm also one of our board certified clinical toxicologists, which is a non-physician toxicologist who does consulting for our state poison center. I have actually published some cardiac arrest research in some journals like Resuscitation and GEMS retrospectively using some very similar methodology that was used in this study, like logistic regression to control for confounders. And I also have a toxicology podcast where I interviewed the lead author of the American Heart Association Cardiac Arrest Due to Poisoning Guidelines. And we talked actually about this exact subject back in 2023. And it's so funny how much different the conversation is now. I really thought I would be, you know, very well qualified to talk about this, but I also see, maybe I'm ruining the surprise here, Dr. Dillon is on the line. So he's probably the most qualified to talk about this since it's his paper, but I'm excited to be here to be part of the conversation.
Well, we love having you here. And yes, we are excited also to have with us some of the authors from this paper. So we'll all be chiming in together and chatting about, you know, what does this mean and why might this be happening? What are these findings? But first, without further ado, I'd like to give a warm welcome to Dr. David Dillon and Dr. Ralph Wong. Thank you so much for making the time to share your work with us.
Hi, yeah. So my name is David Dillon. I am an EMS clinician and researcher at UC Davis and the first author on the article that we're going to be discussing today. And I'm super excited to be here and discuss this. This is something, a topic that's really near and dear to my heart. And I think that our findings are interesting and kind of part of a recent tidal wave of three or four very interesting papers that have come out in the last couple months. So this is extremely topical. And I look forward to discussing this with everybody today. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here.
Hey, everyone. I'm Ralph Wong. I'm a emergency physician at UCSF and last author of the article, and really want to dig into what we found and how we found it.
All right. Well, thank you all so much. This is exciting. And I want to remind our listeners that the name of the paper is Naloxone and Patient Outcomes in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrests in California. And this is published in JAMA Network Open. And the open part is really important and exciting because this means that anybody can read the paper free of charge, doesn't sit behind any paywalls. And so we'll get that dropped in the chat for you all, but I encourage you to take a deep dive into the full paper, as you know, in an hour's time, we're only gonna be able to go through so much of it. And there's a lot of really interesting findings in here. But before we dive into the paper itself, I always like to ask a little bit to the authors, you know, what made you decide to take on this question? What was the impetus?
You want to take that one, Ralph?
I think we decided to look at naloxone in cardiac arrest because we noticed that clinically and in the science, that opioid-associated cardiac arrests has just been skyrocketing. And I think, as everybody knows, through personal experience and media, that opioid-associated deaths and drug-related deaths have, like, just increased dramatically, and mainly driven by fentanyl. And so, this is kind of our response to seeing that increase over time.
I think it's an important effort, and particularly as we see the numbers continue to climb, definitely a topic that is on a lot of our minds, not just professionally, but also personally. So I like that you brought that up. It's easy to think of something that happens to somebody else, but it's hard to find somebody who hasn't been personally affected. I'm curious, from the standpoint of the pharmacologic side, and perhaps Dr. Feldman, you can chime in here on what is the thought? You mentioned that this idea came up a while ago and it wasn't necessarily positively received, but what is the thought around the mechanism of naloxone and cardiac arrest, and what are some of the controversial points on it?
Yeah, well, there's sort of the physiologic and pharmacologic mechanisms, and then there's the sort of systems of care mechanisms where, there's the whole question about, with naloxone being administered more in the pre-hospital setting, how often are we actually identifying true cardiac arrest versus pseudo PEA and resuscitating them with naloxone, which, by the way, is great if you resuscitate a pseudo PEA with naloxone. I'll touch more on the, I suppose, the physiologic and pharmacologic side. So your body has receptors, not so that pharmaceutical companies can design drugs for them, but so that you can use them in a complex interplay of physiology. And we all have natural endorphins in our bodies, right? Beta endorphin. And opioid receptors are stimulated by beta endorphin and a couple of other opioid-like compounds in the body. You can find opioid receptors in the heart and in the vasculature. And actually, if you release beta endorphin in the body, it reduces norepinephrine output from the brain. It can also lead to vascular dilation. There's even cases of bradycardia. So you can have negative cardiovascular effects from opioids, meaning hypotension, bradycardia. We used to kind of rely on this a little bit with morphine for chest pain, hoping we'd get a little vasodilation from histamine release, et cetera. It's not incredibly reliable in how you get these things to happen, but there is probably some negative cardiovascular effects going on during cardiac arrest from opioids. I'll say that the data is really largely based in animals for how much we know a lot of these things happen. There's also actually even, like, protective effects sometimes in acute overdose from opioids on things like neurologic outcome and cardiac ischemia, because opioids might reduce cardiovascular oxygen demand acutely. Chronically, it's kind of a different story. There's been a signal of maybe ischemic preconditioning happening in the heart, which can predispose you to MI. But the point, I guess, I want to make here is, no matter what mental models we make of how opioids work, physiology is often vastly more complex and interrelated than we know. And patients, there absolutely could be an interplay where opioids are somehow decreasing your blood pressure and heart rate, and maybe reversing that is with naloxone is leading to some sort of benefit, whether it's an endogenous opioid or an exogenous opioid, so like fentanyl. And there might be other mechanisms beyond that related to there has been some look at naloxone's ability to change cardiac rhythms when you get to really high doses. So we don't fully know. We just have a signal, and we're kind of hypothesizing on how it might play a role.
I love that we're able to say we don't fully know. I always tell everybody, if I knew what I was doing, it would just be called search, but I have to do research. And I think this is an area where there's a lot of opportunity to grow our knowledge base and to learn. And this is the next natural progression. You mentioned animal studies. Now we're into observational cohort studies. And without stealing Jeff Rollman's thunder, I want to invite him on, because I think in order to understand the findings, we do need to really understand how the study was conducted and where it took place so that we can have that in our heads as we interpret the findings. So, Jeff, welcome. I'm going to turn it to you to walk through with our authors some of the key aspects of our methodology.
Hello, everyone, and definitely a huge honor to be on with all of you. Definitely great to have you here, Dr. Dylan, Dr. Wong, and Dr. Feldman as well as our guest pharmacist expert. Definitely, this was an article that I know many of us read right when this came out and want to learn more about it. So, first off, you could just tell us briefly what exactly were your study goals or objectives so we know what exactly we're trying to find.
Of course. So our study objective was to look at retrospectively to look at an intervention. In this case, it was naloxone administration by EMS providers. And we were really kind of looking at two main outcomes: return to spontaneous circulation, sorry, sustained return to spontaneous circulation. So as defined in the CARES data set of return to spontaneous circulation for 20 minutes or at handoff to the hospital, and survival to hospital discharge.
Yeah, no, very good to have those clear objectives. And then I understand that you conducted a retrospective cohort study of your patients. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what that study type is and why exactly you decided to do a retrospective cohort study?
So our retrospective cohort study was essentially looking at three different Northern California counties between 2015 and 2023. So we essentially looked at all the cardiac arrests in a database that was gathered prior to our research. And we were able to, one of the perks to this is we were able to look at a very large data set because we were able to look at 9 years of data, so 8,000, just over 8,000 cardiac arrests in a reasonably diverse population. We had rural, we had city, and we had a decent sized cohort, which is fantastic. So you have the data to look at this because we weren't expecting huge differences. So you need a large data set to power this. However, and stealing probably some thunder where we're going with this, retrospective studies are fantastic because they're reasonably easy to do. The data is already there and you can just analyze it, but they have some major caveats when it comes to things like confounding. Because the data were already collected, you can't prospectively adjust for things or anticipate problems. So that one of the major limitations in a lot of the work that we're going to talk about today about our methodology was to try to minimize as much as we can bias and confounding, given the fact that all of our data had already been collected.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. I know you did some really advanced statistical techniques that we'll talk about in a bit about how you tried to make sense of it, knowing that these biases likely exist. But first, you mentioned a little bit about kind of where your subjects, where these participants, your study setting occurred. So where exactly were we focused on? What EMS or fire agencies? Since I know some folks who might be joining us, EMTs, paramedics, students from all around the country and the world, they might be thinking, okay, but they only got those results in that area. It doesn't apply to my setting at all. So was wondering, is this just EMS, kind of a third service EMS? Are you including fire-based responses? And then what sort of rural, suburban, urban transport times or distance to arrive on scene, if you could just tell us a little bit about sort of where this took place.
Yeah, I mean, all fantastic questions. And I think really, really important to ask when you're reading a study like this and you're asking yourself, does this actually apply to me? Does this actually apply to my patient population? So when we set this study up, we looked at three separate Northern California counties, one of which is very, very urban, one of which is urban, but then also has a pretty decent chunk of suburban areas. And then we had one county that was pretty much purely rural. And the data that we used for this was actually more on the county level, and it had all cardiac arrests seen by any of the different agencies. So whether it was fire-based or third-party EMS, like all cardiac arrests have quality assurance. In this case, it's similar to the CARES database that you may have heard of before. where you essentially look at cardiac arrest outcomes and what was done. So you can track, completely aside from research, how accurately are we instituting our protocols and what do our outcomes look for this very important problem that is cardiac arrest. So those were the data that we used in these three counties. And I would say, Ralph, like the transport times, I don't know if we had them specifically in the analysis, but just anecdotally knowing the counties we looked at, they're going to be anywhere from a couple of minutes probably to like purely rural transport times of 30 minutes or more.
Yeah, I think there was a range. We didn't dig very deeply into transport times, but I agree that generalizability is always a question. Like, are these the patients that we treat that are in the study? And I would say that California and San Francisco, even though we think of as an area that's particularly hard hit by fentanyl, it turns out that California is has the median number of fentanyl deaths by state, so it's not, in a magnitude, an order of magnitude greater than other places.
Yeah, that makes sense. So sounds like even though we might think, hey, this can't apply to me on the other side of the country, you're right around there, right in the middle, when it comes to comparing to other states.
Well, I just want to add, I was talking to someone from Camden, New Jersey, this past weekend, and he was saying that 80% of the out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in Camden, people had fentanyl in their blood,
That's
which is
wild.
like, mind-blowing, staggering.
Wow. Yeah, that is definitely not the median ranking
That's,
on
yeah,
there. No.
not at all, not at
Or the
all.
mean. Yeah. Wow. And then you'd mentioned briefly about your data. So all this data that you analyze, is this something that your paramedics, EMTs, firefighters, they all knew this study was being done and then they entered something separately, or is this coming just from regular patient care records that was then abstracted and only sort of these CARES patients, so it wouldn't include trauma patients, for example. Just want to make sure we know what the universe is of our data collection.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really important question. So this is essentially the CARES data set. So just to kind of reiterate, because we just touched on that, these are going to be cardiac arrest patients that are presumed to be medical cardiac arrests. So traumas are not included in this. And then these data were collected just purely from the clinical care that was given. There was no extra data analysis form. This was all data that had already been collected as part of that CARES data set and held by each of these counties. So it was no additional data that we collected for this study.
Yeah, and I think that's really important for others to know since this is something that could potentially be replicated in their system. It's not like
Exactly.
you had to hire a research assistant or somebody to full-time collect this. This was just the pre-existing CARES data that almost every EMS agency is already tracking. And then as far as what ultimately made it in, I know you mentioned that the inclusion criteria, so the non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrest with this with attempted resuscitation, but were there any cases that were excluded? What were your exclusion criteria?
Exclusion criteria were patient aged under 18 years. And I think that was the main one. Traumatic cardiac arrest, which would have already been excluded, and then children were the main exclusion. Anything I'm forgetting, Ralph?
I think we excluded cases where we had missing data on the exposure. So if we
That's
didn't
fair.
know if they
Yes.
received naloxone or not, that was that there were a few exclusions, probably less than a few
Less than
percent.
1%, but I think you're right.
Yeah, if you don't have all your data, then hard to run that full analysis. So that makes sense. And then speaking of data, if you could just describe for us briefly what your primary and secondary outcomes were, and then we could also talk about other variables that you were looking at that you thought were important to include in your analysis.
Sure. So the primary outcome was patient survival to hospital discharge. And then the secondary outcome was that sustained return to spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, that we discussed. And we chose those very specifically because ROSC is a very proximal outcome. So it's at the end where it's part of the cardiac arrest care. So you would imagine if you're giving something in a patient in cardiac arrest, you would expect to see a difference or a larger difference in that more proximal outcome. However, there's been a lot of discussion for many, many years about what the appropriate outcomes would be for something like cardiac arrest. And trying to be as patient-centered as possible doesn't really matter if a patient gets ROSC if they go on to die anyways. So I think like our primary outcome of survival to a hospital discharge is trying to be a lot more patient-centric in what we would like to see an intervention or something like naloxone be associated with.
We did look at neurologic outcome, but the data set was really limited. There was a lot of missing data in that variable, and so we left that out.
Yeah, that's understandable. I mean, it's nice to have all these things, these ultimate outcomes to look at, but yeah, if the data is an issue. And then also our exposure, the intervention, of course, was whether a patient received naloxone or not. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, it seems very straightforward. They either did or didn't get Narcan, but a lot goes into that. So were there protocols in these agencies that describe when somebody should be getting Narcan during these cardiac arrests? Or maybe they were calling an online medical control physician and it was up to them whether to give Narcan or not. So how do we even know how these patients deferred, essentially, those who got who received and didn't receive Narcan?
Yeah, so I think so. The intervention itself was naloxone as administered by EMS. And a quick caveat: there are going to be so many caveats to this because, as we were just talking about, this was a retrospective study, so we tried to work with what we had. So the caveat for this initial part is Narcan or naloxone as given by EMS, and the caveat is that it's presumed to be given by EMS because all we have is a little check box of was naloxone given or not. We assume that's because it was given by the EMS providers. However, anecdotally, I know that sometimes this was checked if they got to the scene and a police officer had already given Narcan. They'd be like, yes, it was given, but it wasn't given by those EMS providers. So that's one of the limitations is we assume this was all EMS provider given, but we don't know. Another limitation to this is that we don't know the dose or the timing. So ideally, you would be able to say they gave 4 milligrams naloxone through the IV 5 minutes into a cardiac arrest. And then you can really dig down into like, okay, this dose, this timing, all those are all great questions that we just don't have any data on. Specific to your question about like protocols, I don't know. I know for a fact in this paper, we did not delve into the specific protocols. I happen to know because I've worked with some of or with a lot of these EMS agencies, that all of them have some version of a protocol. That includes naloxone, but not all of them has a version of a cardiac arrest protocol that includes naloxone. However, we all know EMS providers appropriately can change protocols midway. So they come in, they think it's an overdose, they give naloxone, they switch to cardiac arrest, vice versa. But we don't have any specific data in this data set about which protocol they were following, or were they following protocol, or was it a call to an EMS medical director? All very, very important questions that, again, limitation of the retrospective study, we just don't have the information, unfortunately.
Yeah,
Yeah, I will say that ultimately the guidelines for naloxone come from American Heart Association. And if you go through the suspected opioid poisoning algorithm from AHA, it's is the patient apneic? Yes. If the patient's apneic and has a pulse, that person gets naloxone. But if the person is apneic and doesn't have a pulse, it says consider naloxone, and it puts providers in this kind of nebulous zone. And so there's a lot of uncertainty there. That's because there's no clinical trial evidence to guide that question. I'm foreshadowing a little bit, but that's led to a lot of variability in naloxone administration. Looking at three studies published in the last year, naloxone administration ranges anywhere from like 20% to 66% in one of the EMS agencies in San Francisco. It was like 80% of patients who were presumed to be drug related were getting naloxone. So there's a lot of variability, and that reflects the uncertainty in the guidelines.
Yeah, that's why we need these studies, and that's why we need to keep on looking back at the evidence to make sure that we're following wherever the evidence leads us. So going back to some of this sort of paramedic judgment call, I know you mentioned that cardiac arrest is drug related when it's caused by a known or presumed overdose of some sort of legal or illegal substances, but again, this is left up to that treating EMS clinician. So essentially case by case on whether they think it is drug related. And for some of the data for these variables that you included, some of the covariates that were included in all these patients were things like age, their sex, the initial cardiac rhythm, comorbid conditions, whether it was witnessed, and whether the cause of arrest was drug related in the opinion of that EMS provider. But there were some other covariates that I saw that you considered, but you didn't ultimately include them. So things like bystander CPR, the location of arrest, and then the use of an AED. And I know some of our audience is probably thinking, yes, we know bystander CPR is so important. AED use from first responders is so important. How come they didn't include that in their model?
I mean, it's a great question. We had anticipated including it, but one of the things we came across, and this is kind of speaking to the retrospective aspect of this, is we had what's called collinearity. And what that really boils down to is if I have three separate variables that are all describing the same thing, even though it's described in slightly different ways, then they're all going to look very, very similar. So when you toss them all into analysis, they're going to be what's called collinear. They're going to describe the same thing. So you choose one of those variables, one approach, and this is a ongoing topic of fierce debate among statisticians and researchers. And how do you deal with collinearity? You try to avoid it. You try not to have multiple variables describing the same thing. Sometimes it happens. So our approach to this, which has its pros and its cons, is to essentially remove some of the variables that were collinear with other variables in our data set. So for instance, bystander CPR, I think off the top of my head was collinear with was the arrest witnessed. If it was witnessed, they got bystander CPR. If it wasn't witnessed, they didn't get bystander CPR. So which one are you going to choose? We chose to include witnessed, but that's just kind of one example. And we can, if we wanted to, we could get into a very deep methodological discussion about the, like I said, the pros and cons. But we just tried to be very explicit and transparent with how we set this up, so that you can kind of understand how we did it if you wanted to replicate it yourself.
Yeah, appreciate you sharing all that. And then moving on into our statistical analysis, since I know our audience members are really, chomping at the bits trying to get to the results and see what you actually found. But first, we got to look at again what you're measuring. So of course, you shared with us first our descriptive results. So kind of counts, percentages, means, medians. You did some logistic regression models where you were able to include variables, adjust for things like that age, sex, drug-related causes. But some of that more kind of fancy statistics that you had to do for this selection bias, since we know that it's not at all random who's getting Narcan and who's not. So if you could just briefly, before we move on to the results, kind of tell us some of these things that you had to do to the data in order to try to minimize this risk of bias, and then why we now can trust your results after that.
Of course. So I'll try to keep it pretty high level here just because we did quite a
Please.
few things. But the main two that I think we'll talk about today, because I think that they are the main thrust of the paper, is we did two propensity score-based models. And what this is propensity scores essentially look at the probability that an individual would actually receive the treatment, and then they do something with that. Maybe they match it from a control to somebody that got the treatment. So you try to compare similar people. Maybe you do kind of fancy weighting to try to do this, but you're essentially trying to control for who should have gotten the treatment and who did get the treatment. So that was one approach we did. And then the other approach we did was those logistic regressions that you're talking about. We included an interaction term. all that'll let us do is look at subgroups really, really well. So we could look at people who had presumed drug-related arrest who got naloxone, people who did not have presumed drug-related arrest who got naloxone, and kind of compare between them. So essentially, all of these analyses, all of these very fancy statistical methods are going towards minimizing that risk or that bias that we discussed before, about the fact that we're using retrospective data.
Can I, not to derail, but this is such a great opportunity for me to ask a question. I would really love to know a little bit more about propensity matching in terms of the naloxone. So it was largely, it basically modeled out who was most likely to get naloxone, which is probably younger patients with less comorbidities, et cetera. But it
Younger,
wasn't
sure.
necessarily a disease severity, because when so I've done a little bit of this kind of research, and we were comparing vasopressors after cardiac arrest, and we tried to match by disease severity, where the people who had a sim, which is really hard to predict in cardiac arrest, there's not a great score, but it was basically we tried to have the same populations be, the group that got norepi was just as sick as the group that got epi. But this was more propensity match based off of whether or not you were likely to get naloxone as opposed to like a cardiac arrest risk score.
Yeah, it wasn't cardiac arrest risk. Sorry, Ralph. I see you.
Oh, I was just going to say the way to think about propensity scores is, so we have observational data, and the main problem is confounding. So let's say a confounder is something that causes the exposure and causes the outcome. So a good example of a confounder in this study would be age. So age is causing you to give naloxone, and age is causing you to survive. And that creates this backdoor pathway that makes naloxone look good.
Right.
So we try to overcome this by creating a propensity score. And the propensity score hopefully creates these balanced groups. So a naloxone group that's similar to a no naloxone group, especially in terms of the propensity to receive naloxone.
Right. So the confounder is controlled for. So
Right.
yeah. Okay. So I didn't want to derail us too much, but I was just
No,
curious.
I think it's a really good question. And I think, like, again, propensity scores and why you use them and how you use them. And the other thing we haven't touched on is propensity score itself is just a tool. You can then take that number and do so many things with it. The easiest one to think about is matching that we've been talking about, taking somebody from the exposed group, so the people that got naloxone, and looking for somebody in the control group that did not get naloxone, and trying to match them with a similar propensity score so that all their other covariates and all their other risk is essentially as equitable as possible, and then just trying to figure out what the naloxone did. But you can also use this same score, and one of the other models we did was to actually use it to weight things and all this. And like each of those have different pros and cons, but the basic idea here is that we're trying to minimize those confounders as much as possible.
Yeah, and I want to thank for the question too, because I think a lot of times we read these method sections with big jargon, and our tendency might be to try to skip over it and just, I can't possibly understand it. But taking the time to take a step back and understand, well, what was the purpose of doing this? Oh, well, we didn't have a randomized experiment. We have a natural experiment where some patients are getting the intervention and some aren't. So it's really important that we look at this a couple of different ways, and one of those ways being the propensity matching.
Yeah, and I think just the final thing I'll say on this, because I know we've been sitting on our propensity scores for a while now, is that one of the reasons we did this so many different ways is because each of them has their pros and their cons. And if you slice the pie five separate ways and it gives you the exact same result every single time, that's reassuring. That's suggesting that the underlying actual association is actually there. Because like I said, if each of these methods has some things that make it better, some things that make it worse, but no two methods are the exact same. So we actually did several different approaches here, and we're finding the same result, which is more reassuring when we're looking at something retrospectively that that association may actually be real.
I think that's a really important point and a nice segue into results. I do want to show what you actually found. We've hinted at it, but I think it's the drum roll moment now. You mentioned early on that because of this retrospective data source, it's a really rich data source where you're able to get a larger group of patients than you might in something like a randomized control trial where you have to enroll each patient and wait. So your overall total was over 8,000 patients, even after applying the inclusion and exclusion criteria. And we talk a lot on this podcast about the traditional structure of a paper. So, table one is that traditional table one, looking at the characteristics of the patients who were ultimately included. But I really like what you've done too by creating columns for the exposed group, those who got naloxone, and the unexposed group, those who did not have documentation of naloxone, and comparing those. And so, at a high level, curious, what were the findings? And we kind of hinted at a few of them that maybe aren't surprising, but what were the big things that we should keep in mind that were different between the naloxone group and the no naloxone group?
Sure. So the first thing that I'll want to draw all of the reader's eyes to is that we also included the p-value here. You don't always include p-values in table one, but we really wanted to highlight that this was a retrospective study and these groups look different. They look different at baseline. Every single one of those p-values is statistically significant, right? So that's comparing the naloxone to the no naloxone group. So even at baseline, we do have a high risk of bias, which is why we did so many different statistical approaches. But directly to your question, Remley, a couple of things that come up are that patients who received naloxone were more likely to be men. They're more likely to be younger. They're more likely to have fewer comorbidities, are a couple of the big ones that especially jump out at you from this table one.
Yeah, and those things could certainly influence the outcome. Like Dr. Wong was saying, oh, these are related to the exposure and also related to the outcome. So we need to keep those in mind. Something else that I thought was interesting was just the proportion of cases given naloxone and how that almost two-thirds, 60% of the cases who received naloxone actually didn't have documentation of suspected drug use. And so it makes me curious, and I know we don't have the answer to what's in the protocols, but is this a kitchen sink medication where if we don't know what to do, we throw it? But that seemed like a really high proportion to me, and I thought that was an interesting finding.
Yeah, so this is one of the interesting things that we don't know. We have a couple of hypotheses. It could be a kitchen sink. It could be a we gave naloxone, it didn't help. So then when the EMS providers are filling out their data analysis kind of at the end of the cardiac arrest, they're like, well, we gave it and it didn't help the patient. They're still in cardiac arrest. So it probably wasn't drug related. That's just the random hypothesis, but like we don't know, I guess is the best way to say that. But we also know that a significant proportion of people who were not presumed to be in drug-related cardiac arrest ended up getting naloxone.
Yeah, and I'm curious to hear from Dr. Feldman on, do you have thoughts around the kitchen sink approach? What are the dangers associated with giving naloxone if there's not potentially an opioid-related cause?
In a non-opioid related cause, I think they are pretty minimal, but truly the data is not set in stone as we're looking mainly at animal data. You have some animal data showing an acute overdose opioids can actually maybe prevent ischemic reperfusion injury and prevent ischemic heart damage. So maybe you're antagonizing your small amount of beta endorphins that are doing those, but that's pretty unlikely to have any significant impact, though, the signal has not yet been searched out. I think largely it's pretty safe. You're probably at a higher risk in someone who actually is an opioid user, in which case, because there's case reports of things like Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy from precipitating withdrawal. I think our best leading hypothesis of how we're getting a signal here is a massive increase in catecholamine from naloxone. Not a massive, but an increase in catecholamine somehow helping out here. It can't be the only way. Otherwise, you could probably just give more epi, right, and see the exact same result. But that's sort of like the simplest and most clear discussion point how it could be having an effect.
One other thing that I wanted to bring up to just kind of piggyback on that is one of the downsides to giving naloxone or a kitchen sink approach is that cardiac arrest is very time sensitive and it's task saturated, right? Like this is less of a pharmacologic thing and more of just like a pure logistics. But if you're trying to run ACLS, you're trying to run a cardiac arrest, for you to go back and get your naloxone from a bag and give it, you're not doing something else. Whether that something else is something that's more data driven, like high quality CPR or your initial doses of epinephrine. So I would argue, I would say that one of the downsides to just giving naloxone is that in such a task saturated clinical situation, we should really be doing the things that have data behind them that have been shown to help patients.
Yeah, definitely. And that's an important consideration with study setting. I know we talked that there was a variety of study settings here from urban to rural. And in an urban setting where you have a lot of extra hands potentially, that may be a consideration. But when it's just you and one other clinician alone, a far distance from the hospital, you may want to resource or write different protocols. So I think all of these are really important things, and it's always a it depends answer versus yeah, we should all do this thing. There's very rarely a binary yes or no answer on any of this. But I do want to look at table two as well, because this is where we start to get that signal. And Dr. Feldman mentioned, I think we're seeing a signal here. And one of the things that we see in table two is that the naloxone group actually was more likely to obtain sustained ROSC. And I know you emphasize that patient, that definition, Dr. Dillon. I think it's an important one because we know that rearrest is common, but sustained ROSC was more likely in the naloxone group. It was something like 35% versus 23%. And that same direction of the finding was seen for the primary outcome of discharge from the hospital, 16% in the naloxone group versus 10% in the non-naloxone group. But this comes with those caveats from the difference in the population. So we should take this part with a grain of salt. And I do want to move into some of the other analyses because, as was mentioned, this was looked at a lot of different ways and we get a consistent answer here. So taking a quick look at table three from the logistic regression model, seeing that the odds of a positive outcome here are increased again for that group that was given naloxone, or the for Table three rather refers to the odds of getting naloxone, which were associated with those characteristics we mentioned, younger patients, patients with presumed overdose. And that becomes a really important piece as we look at the adjusted findings. I should have drum rolled because I revealed them too early, but here we are. Surprise, spoiler alert, naloxone was associated with improved both outcomes, sustained ROSC and survival to discharge. Interested in your thoughts and interpretations on anything we should think about as we're looking at these results, which are in table four, by the way, as we look at the adjusted findings. These hold true even after including the things that Jeff mentioned early on, age, sex, the initial rhythm, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think this is there's two tables that are kind of the meat of the results. Table four, which we're about to look at, and then table five, which looks at some of the subgroups. But I think the main thing I would take away from table four is that we tried to do several different approaches here. You have the nearest neighbor propensity matching, the inverse probability weighted regression adjustment. Those are just both propensity score models that we were just talking about, and they both show very similar results. They show that naloxone is associated with an increased return of spontaneous circulation. Whew, excuse me, increased return of spontaneous circulation and an increased survival to hospital discharge. The treatment effect in the treated is something we haven't touched on here. I think the main thing to take away from there is it's another way to slice data. And using this other way, it shows very similar results. So when you're looking at this, you can say that there's the absolute risk difference is like the pure percentage difference. You can talk about relative risk. I think another way to think about this that I find a little bit more digestible is a number needed to treat. So a number needed to treat is the number of patients that needed to have been given naloxone to have one additional improved outcome. So for these data, it was 9 for return to spontaneous circulation. So for every 9 patients given naloxone, one had improved outcome. And then the number needed to treat for survival to hospital discharge was 26. So just to put this all in context, because like what do these numbers even mean? Epinephrine in cardiac arrest has a number needed to treat of 112. So you need to treat 112 patients with epinephrine to have one improved cardiac or one improved outcome.
Is
Now, it's, so
that
these
survival?
And so these numbers are absolutely crazy. And I'm not trying to stand here and say that naloxone is somewhere between 4 and 10 times better than epinephrine in cardiac arrest. However, I think there's a lot of confounding that we've talked about, but the association is here that naloxone may be helpful. It's associated with improved outcomes, at a pretty remarkable rate. And I think that would be my main thrust, my main takeaway from this table four.
Yeah, and that stays consistent in subgroups is also important. And you mentioned slicing and dicing, it, using valid methods in different appropriate ways is helpful to build a degree of certainty around this. And I do want to invite our other panelists to join at any time and bring their questions because these results initially are very exciting. And I think it tells us, like a lot of good research, there's more questions to be answered, but this is definitely an area worth investing in. And that's sort of the natural progression of research. We start with some animal studies, move into retrospective studies, and then take this on and say, well, we really need some studies where we can infer causality a little bit better. And we've talked a lot on the show about, one study is one study, and retrospective inferring causality is going to be very challenging. But this still is a really exciting result for us and tells us that there's more to learn.
Can I jump in just for a minute
Please
too?
hop in.
So I totally agree. It's really interesting to see such a large treatment impact. I think it's important to hedge that this is in the context of naloxone with all standard ACLS care. So
Important.
it's not you could actually take every. So this is also one of three studies published just this year on this topic. Two were positive. One was actually didn't see a difference. So when we look at the whole context, it's really there is a positive signal, two out of three. It doesn't necessarily, there's definitely a population that seems like it could benefit based off the association, but there might be a population that doesn't. But it has to also be employed, just as Dr. Dillon said, with doing the other things. And if you are avoiding doing the other things to run and get naloxone out of your bag because you think that it is a panacea of pharmaceutical that can fix things, we're probably messing up. Because the number needed to treat, for bagging a patient, is like one, right? Like it's one, like if you don't bag that one patient, they're gonna die if they're at me. So like those other BLS cares that are already well incorporated and ACLS cares would have to be going on in tandem. And in theory, you could like re-chop up all this data. It's all retrospective data. So you could redo this backwards and say, younger patients who have a cardiac arrest are more likely to survive even if you do logistic regression for receipt of naloxone, right? Like it's the whole sort of backward, or
I
get
agree,
epi
yeah.
and all those things. I mean, it's really great. I find it fascinating and super helpful, but definitely one of those things to chop it
I
up.
agree 100%. And I do want to like take a small step back and say I am not in favor of giving naloxone to everybody based off of our results, right? We have talked so much in the last 45 minutes about how there are so many limitations, and we tried our best. And I think the main thing to take from this, without stealing thunder for like our conclusion, is that like this is a really interesting outcome and these are really interesting results. But the things that you should be doing are the data-driven things like bagging your patient, high quality CPR, give your epinephrine. Like there are randomized controlled trials around these things that are much stronger data. And I think adding naloxone is just that. It would be adding naloxone. And I think in this retrospective study, it's not strong enough, even though it's super, super interesting. And it's gonna be the basis of like a lot of additional study and additional work moving forward. This should not move your needle on what you're doing clinically today. There are just too many confounders and too many other things. Like younger patients are going to survive cardiac arrest at a much higher rate. They're also going to get naloxone at a much higher rate. We can bend over backwards with statistics to try to make that bias as small as possible, but we're never going to get rid of
Statistics is not magic. That could be our t-shirt for the day.
it.
I love that. I see Dr. Toon, you've joined. You've got a question.
Well, first of all, you're all very young.
Thank you.
Yes, you're all very young. And so I worked in New York City in the 80s when we had the heroin crisis. And we used a much smaller dose of Narcan. But the rationale as paramedics at the time is that if it's a cardiac arrest, it's also an unconscious unknown. So we would routinely give dextrose because we didn't have glucometers. We'd give dextrose and Narcan. And I did work under several protocols in New York State where Narcan and dextrose were routine parts of the protocol. But this was all well before we understood the most important thing we need to do, high quality CPR. This
Agreed.
was back when we would have pauses that went 90 seconds. We did stacked shocking, and you didn't do anything in between the shocks. I mean, it is truly ancient history, but it's not the first time it's been done. Which gets back to me reinforcing what I really like that you said. There's two things we know right now, beyond a reasonable doubt: high quality CPR and better living through electricity. We know those two things are really, really valuable. We're still not 100% sure about everything else. And then even coming into play now is the question about ventilations. But we, after all these years, we still don't have a concrete answer on ventilations. We see some things that are telling us, but we don't know about ventilations. So where in the priority of things the research needs to be done? I don't know. I think maybe a little bit more work on the question of ventilation. But this just is fascinating that it was done. And I find it very interesting. And I love to see the changes over time because, you know, in almost 50 years of doing this, it's very interesting to see all the changes that have taken place. But the nicest part about the changes is they are based upon studying and research, not, hey, this sounds like a great idea. Let's just go ahead and do it. And there was a lot of that when I started doing what I did. And so it is interesting. So I still want to emphasize, we know about high quality CPR and we know about defibrillation. Now we need to figure out what's the rest of the secret sauce.
Well, I'm not as old as Bill Toon, thankfully, but I do remember the days of 2 amps of bicarb and, you know, a few minutes of EOA placement before you actually, you know, were going to circulate all the epinephrine that you had put in a la, you know, megadose. So, I do agree 1,000% that we're better off doing research. And I do think ventilation is a big part of this. Not to take away from what we're talking about right now, I would absolutely ask everybody to go to prehospitalcare.org. We're having several workshops, one of them focused on ventilations at the Medical College of Wisconsin in February in Milwaukee. So you better go prepared for winter and lock yourself in to do great research. Our usual two workshops that we do at ESO in Austin, where the weather is better. And we have connections to get your outcomes, you know, so even better. But going back to this particular paper, you've mentioned pre-ischemic conditioning, and it is definitely something that's fascinating. I want you to look in your crystal ball and not to have rogue paramedics start to give Narcan to every patient they come about. We've always thought H's and T's. We've always thought, what's the cause of this cardiac arrest? So let's fix it. I was also giving thiamine, you know, D50 and Narcan to everybody I came across just because they looked like they were a little altered. And I know that we're not doing that anymore. But what, look in that crystal ball for me and think, maybe a bit of Narcan is potentially going to be helpful on all cardiac arrests.
It's a really interesting question. And I mean, like, this gets specifically to table five, knowing that we don't have too much time left. So making this quick, one of the things that we weren't anticipating is when we look at two, so the third and the fourth line in table five, the non-drug related cardiac arrest treated with naloxone and the presumed drug related cardiac arrest treated with naloxone, we see a positive association all the way out to survival to hospital discharge in both of those. And we were expecting it. Our hypothesis was that it would be there for the presumed drug-related cardiac arrests because we're thinking that we're treating opiate overdose or opiate-associated arrests. However, we did not expect it in the non-presumed drug-related cardiac arrest cohort, but we found it. So there's a couple of different ideas we have of why this could be true. One of the first and foremost, one of the big ones is we think it might be misclassification. We've done other studies showing that presumed cardiac arrest. So people that are like, this is 100%, they just had a heart attack, it's something primary cardiac, somewhere between 10 and 17% of those, depending, may actually be occult overdose. So somebody that overdosed, no signs of overdose on scene, nobody thought they were an overdose. But when you actually do an autopsy study, you find lethal levels of opiates in their system. So this may be misclassification in that group. But then I also want to, at least looking in that crystal ball, maybe there are some physiologic hypotheses or physiologic reasons where naloxone may be helping this non-drug related cardiac arrest group as well. I think this is one of those results that, like, wiggles its eyebrows suggestively without giving you a true answer, right? This is interesting. It's hypothesis generating, but I don't think this necessarily answers a question at this point.
Yeah.
That's why we want to put it in the water.
I'm in favor. All right, I have the unpopular task. So Jeff, I'm going to turn it to you for a question and then I get the last question and I
sure.
will carry.
Well, you already answered my first question about what policy changes to make over this, that it seems like even though we're really excited, maybe we should be given Narcan to everybody and their mother and cardiac arrest. Probably need to hold off a little bit, even though you did provide really strong research here. But I was wondering how this might apply in other parts of the country where methamphetamine or other stimulants are the leading cause of death in drug overdoses rather than opioids. For in San Antonio, about 60 to 70% of our drug-related deaths have stimulants in them. And I was thinking, how might these results apply? And interesting to have the clinical pharmacists here as well in the context of drug overdose deaths becoming increasingly stimulant-related.
So the one thing I'll say real quick, and then we can toss it over to our pharmacist, is that in the populations that we looked at here, we didn't report on it here, but just anecdotally, stimulant death and stimulant-related cardiac arrests are a large proportion. Like Northern California, we deal with, like most of the country, we have a big methamphetamine problem. So it's baked into these data are probably a large, unrecognized stimulant patient population as well. And then I'll let our pharmacist chime in.
Yeah, I should probably disclose that I do some medical legal expert witness work on determining drug-related relative contribution to fatalities. Methamphetamine, you know, a death from methamphetamine specifically usually looks very different than a death from opioids. So my guess is it's not, you know, if methamphetamine was there, did it play a role? Absolutely. No system can, you know, everything interacts, but it wasn't necessarily a methamphetamine. They if the opioids were there, they may have also died from the opioids, but had methamphetamine in their system. Just a thing to differentiate a little bit. Whether or not, you know, that predisposes them to having some kind of an increased risk of arrhythmia or something from having excess catecholamine from meth being there, who knows? We're still trying to figure out, you know, whether this is even a drug-related thing versus non-drug-related, or whether this applies to populations where people don't have high amounts of drug overdose. In fact, I would think in the populations where there is a high amount of drug overdose, like Camden, New Jersey, this would be way more applicable because of all the pseudo-PEA that you prevent cardiac arrest in. But we still don't even know
more
that.
Research it's, is necessary? I've never heard of
that. I know. Yeah, it's really like this is a beautiful signal. The signal is absolutely there. It's in the water. It's in the air. It's in our minds. It's time to actually prove it. And I think that should be the next step forward.
Well, thank you all.
Ryan, do you have $10 million? We can do that.
I think you're going to be better at getting that from someone than me. If you want to give me a grant writing course, I'm happy to come attend.
I love it. And Dr. Feldman has led so nicely into my last question for our authors around what's next. Perhaps you could give us a sneak preview at what we should be on the lookout for before I send everybody off to their days.
Yeah. So what's next? The next thing is randomized clinical trials. We want to prove in a prospective fashion whether naloxone is actually helpful in cardiac arrest, and to try to adjust for some of all these limitations we just discussed, the best way to do it are to enroll patients prospectively and randomize them in some fashion to naloxone versus no naloxone, or a lot of naloxone versus a little bit of naloxone. But those prospective randomized clinical trials are the next thing. We currently have a couple studies under review to get funded, maybe get those $10 million, we'll see. But I think that is the next step, and that is the point. Once we start getting clinical trials that show positive results, that is the point where I would change my clinical practice. But until then, continue the course with the high quality CPR and everything else we know actually works.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great place to wrap us up and for us to take into consideration as we get excited about this study, because it is exciting. I want to thank all of our panelists again. Thank you, Dr. Feldman. Thank you, Dr. Wong. Thank you, Dr. Dillon, for sharing your time and expertise with us. What a fascinating conversation. I certainly could keep us here all day, but I won't. So thank you once again, and I look forward to reading the next studies as they come out. For our audience, before you go, a couple of reminders. We will have the Education Research Journal Club version of this podcast on Friday, November 22nd. And then we will return for the last podcast of the year, hard to believe it, second Monday of the month, which will be December 9th. Thank you all again for listening, and we look forward to catching you next month.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data.